Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog, live here on Dave Martell YouTube channel, every single Monday and every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Tonight, we have a really awesome guest. Before we get started, if you like The Bog, you support The Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You can get a sticker, you can get a mug, and most importantly, you get the RSS feed so you can get audio of every single show that we do in your car, on your commutes, at work, or at the gym, so you can listen to on your phone, all audio. That's patreon.com/TheBog. Go check it out. Help us keep the lights on. You want to support The Bog another way, make sure to go to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and check out some sweet merch. It is White Boy Summer. Get yourself a cutoff. Get yourself a muscle shirt. Sundresses for the ladies. Onesies for the babies. And for the esoteric order of grill dads, we have artisan chef aprons that have the Bog logo. So go check out shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure to go to facebook.com/IronAgeJody. And check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. This stuff is incredible. I got a reading. We all got readings on the Bog panel. We had Neil John on a few times. Blew my mind. Blew all the viewers' minds. So go check it out. Go give them a like at facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. If you decide to get a reading, tell them Big Dave sent you. Make sure to let them know that Big Dave sent you. And one more announcement. Coming very, very soon. Coming in less than a month, we have the Bizarre Archives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines. It is a compilation of amateur authors writing in the vein of Conan all the way up to Cthulhu, fantasy, sci-fi, and horror, short stories all compiled from our guys or from around the community. That's coming out very, very soon. I'll let you guys know when that's available. But tonight we have our good friend, Mr. Mike from the Imperium Press. He's coming back on the show. And tonight we're going to talk about his newest release from Imperium Press, and that is something that's very special to us in the heathen sphere, and that is Beowulf. So what's going on tonight, Mike?
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be back.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So let's get right into it. Let's talk about, real quickly, about Beowulf. Why you decided to kind of do a reissue, a republishing of Beowulf, what kind of motivated you to do that, as well as, kind of your process of it.
Right. So as far as the release is concerned, this was something that was in the works for quite a while, actually. It's part of, we have a series that we're putting out. Actually, the very first thing Imperium Press ever released was Iliad. It was the inaugural release of the company, but as well, it was the inaugural release of the Western Canon series. And that's exactly what it sounds like. These are the foundational cornerstone texts of the Western Canon, of our tradition, of what makes us on a linguistic and cultural level. And Beowulf is the second release in that series. So I thought it was pretty fitting. Iliad really is sort of, it's the first release in the Western canon, or the first poem in the Western canon. It's kind of hard to call it a release. It was released for us. Mm-hmm. But Beowulf is, I think, deserving of equal standing. And if you read the introduction to our edition, which you can get at imperiumpress.org, the introduction is by a right-wing Chad named Aidan McClear, and he agrees. He thinks that Beowulf is the equal of the Iliad, and I tend to agree with him. So we thought that was a good release to bring out as our second release. It obviously has Christian elements in it, so this is a nod as much to our heathen brothers as it is to our Christian bros. So we thought that was a good one to bring out. But as we're going to talk about today, there are many and deep heathen and pagan themes in Beowulf. And I think that this is something that actually gets underplayed a lot these days because of the general sort of arc of Old English scholarship in the 20th century. And another reason why we put it out, I think that the best edition of it had yet to be released, to be honest. We've put out an edition by Francis Gumera, who is a who was a Beowulf scholar. It came out in, I believe, 1909, so you got that good old school 19th century scholarship. Very, very impressive. It's actually in the original alliterative meter of Beowulf, so you get the feel of the poetry. And he actually explains this meter in the introduction, and it's excellent. It's the best poetic rendering and the best rendering period of Beowulf. And you can kind of compare it a bit to both Tolkien's and Seamus Heaney's editions, which are sort of the foremost editions available now. Tolkien, obviously a giant in literary circles, in our circles, but he didn't think his translation was quite worthy of publication, never saw a publication in his lifetime. It's very good. It's a prose edition, so it sort of doesn't have the poetry. And I think that the main reason why it is celebrated today is because of Tolkien himself. I don't think it's particularly impressive, but it's still good, definitely. Seamus Heaney is the foremost verse or poetic rendition, but he takes a lot of liberties with the text. And I think that Gumera does both better than either of these guys. So he's using the original alliterative meter. He was also a scholar of poetry, an excellent poet in his own right. And he also was a Germanic scholar. So our edition is extensively footnoted, lots and lots of material in there, supplementary material, indexes, glossaries of names, genealogies, maps, and all these things that you kind of expect from an Imperium press release. So I have no compunction in saying that this is the foremost edition of Beowulf available today.
I would actually agree. I actually got my copy on Tuesday, last Tuesday. I haven't had a chance to sit down and read it. I read Beowulf kind of when I first became a heathen, right? I read it in its entirety then. And the only other time I kind of opened it back up was for, you know, research purposes. I had to go find some passages and stuff like that. But I have not read it back in its entirety since that time. So now that I have the Imperium Press version, I am going to go back in and read it in its entirety and re-experience it. But I will say this: I opened the Imperium. I have Tolkien's version. I have another version. I'm not sure who translated that. I opened the Imperium Press. I have to just say this: this is my second Imperium Press book. Imperium Press books, for even though you guys are an independent publishing operation, the quality of format, the quality of layout is impeccable. You know, there's so many, you know, really great independent publishers out there that do a very good job, but because they don't have these huge teams of people and stuff like that, there's some mistakes. There'll be some typographical mistakes. There'll be some grammar, blah, blah, blah. Like, there'll be some mistakes, some bleed errors or whatever. And that's just expected with independent publishing. Your guys' stuff is, like, flawless. It's, like, really, really polished stuff. You would think it comes out of a multi-million-dollar, you know, company. But another thing that I really love, and Mike actually didn't mention this, is that it has the Old English right next to the English, side by side, which is...
How could I have forgotten?
Yeah.
Thank you for mentioning that, yes.
That was the thing that when I paged through it, I was like, this is great. It has the Old English right next to it, because the one translation that I have has both, but it's like the Old English is kind of in footnotes in the back. It's not even like really present, whereas you guys, you have it. It's right there side by side, which is really, really good. So I'm going to go back through and I'm going to read it again from Imperium Press. And so getting into Beowulf itself, and you said that it's available on your website, which is imperiumpress.org, right?
You got it.
Yeah, so folks, go over there and grab yourself a copy. As Mike said, this is the best. This isn't just from our guys, because I am very pro-nepotism. I love nepotism. You know, I mean, when I say something, you know, support folk economy, I'll spend money with my folk just to spend money. I'll spend extra money with my folk just to support my folk. This is legitimately the best copy of Beowulf on the market, period, in the world. So go get yourself a copy. I'm not just saying that to kiss his butt because he's my buddy. I'm saying that because it's true. But let's go on to the themes of Beowulf. For folks that maybe have not read Beowulf, can you give us a brief overview of kind of the story of what Beowulf is?
No problem. Yeah, so Beowulf is just a tiny bit of historical background. Beowulf is an old English poem, we think probably composed right around the year 700 AD or CE, and it was composed by a Christian monk. This is not something that is exactly like, an old folk lay or something like that. But as we'll talk about, there are many, many elements in it that there are so many folk and traditional elements in it that it is, it's actually quite striking when you look at it. But it's obviously been constructed with great care by someone that knows these lays and these stories very well. But it was a Christian monk, and you can read quite a bit of Christian imagery in Beowulf. But for the trunk of the poem is actually as a pagan or heathen story. And it's about a character that probably existed, or it's hard to say. There are some parallels in Scandinavian myth of Beowulf, the character. There is definitely.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you what you think of the theory about Beowulf being Bodvar Bjarki.
I think that there is credence to that, and I'll definitely sort of expand upon that. Going forward, Beowulf also has elements that reach back to Indo-European times, which I think is quite striking as well. But as far as an outline of the poem itself, it clearly concerns historical characters in the migration era, which is obviously the era of people sort of shifting around all the different Germanic tribes in the aftermath of the collapse of the Roman Empire. And as far as an outline of the story, it's basically sort of could be split into two parts and maybe five parts. The two-part kind of explanation is that on the one hand, you've got what you might think of as the cleansing of Heorot. So Beowulf, who is a Geat, or a Swede, he offers to help Hrothgar, who's king of the Danes, to rid Hrothgar's people of the monster Grendel that's been terrorizing them every night. Beowulf then goes ahead and does this, but then he sort of calls down the wrath of Grendel's mother on the Geats, and who then attacks them as Grendel had. Beowulf defeats her. He gets a great reward from Hrothgar, and eventually he becomes king of the Geats. So that's the first part of the story. The second part of the story is the slaying of the dragon. So after ruling for 50 years, Geatland is then ravaged by a dragon when Beowulf is an old man. And then after Beowulf's hall is burned down, he then goes to meet the dragon at its lair, which is filled with all this treasure and everything. He brings with him his kinsman Wiglaf, and then he slays the dragon, but he receives his death wound. And then at the end of the poem, he's buried in this beautiful heathen burial custom, funeral pyre, to great fanfare among his people. So that's basically the TLDR. I should have given a spoiler alert for this 1,300-year-old poem, but that is it in a nutshell there for people who've not read it.
So there's, I believe, I can't remember if it says it in there, but what do you think about the character Beowulf possibly being related to the Skildung clan?
Um, So there's so many parallels. The thing is with Beowulf, there are so many parallels with him. He has Iranian parallels. He has Scandinavian parallels. There are parallels in construction that with the Greeks. There's an ancient folktale tale type that it goes into that basically resonates with Beowulf. As far as the connection with the Skildings or Skildungs, it talks about this in the beginning of the poem. Basically, Skild Scheffing, I believe is the name of the character, is sort of introduced as the ancestor of these people that that Beowulf then goes to see at their court. And I think that this is actually quite significant because Skild is kind of this mythical figure, this almost like you get the motif of the baby in the basket, like with Romulus and Remus, or even with Moses. I mean, it's a very, very ancient motif, and it's very deep, and it goes into a lot of cultures. And you get this here in Beowulf as well. This is something I don't think that was necessarily taken from the Bible itself, even though you can obviously see it in the story of Moses. But what's interesting, I think, here, you get a lot of these parallels with the Beowulf story. So you get like I said, it was divided into two halves. The first half is kind of like the rising of Beowulf, him and his youth and strength, and the second half of the poem is kind of him in the sunset of his life. And you get these interesting parallels where the beginning of the story starts kind of with ice or with water, and this is the coming of Skild Scheffing in the boat, basically. Like, water is sort of it's emphasized in the imagery at the beginning of the story, very much so. And then it kind of closes, the whole poem closes at the end with the funeral pyre of Beowulf. So it comes in with ice and water, and it goes out with fire. So it's quite a striking sort of parallel between these two halves. But yeah, I think that there's definitely something to that. The poet starts the story out with Skild Scheffing, and then Beowulf of a different, like he's a different Beowulf. And then later the Beowulf of the story comes in. But I think the poet did that not by accident or not, unthinkingly. He did that on purpose. And I think it's very important that he bring the Skilding clan in at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, the reason that I'm asking that, and for folks that remember, we did an episode called Return of the Ancient Kings, and my king that I chose to talk about was King Skef, who is, who sired the Skildungs, who you're talking about. He's sometimes pronounced Chef or Sheva or Skaif. He's pronounced, it's pronounced many different ways. But King Skef very much is kind of talked about as the sire of Beowulf and the sire of many different tribes, that also being the Skildung clan. And for those of you that have names like maybe like Chef or Sheffer or I don't know, if you have an S-C-H-E or A-F in your name, that particle is what many linguists have connected to King Skef. And many of us heathens believe that he was a real god, a real guy that sired a lot of the populations of Northern Europe. But that's a whole nother thing. But going back to Beowulf, you mentioned that there are a lot of striking heathen themes and even Indo-European themes. And I wanted to, the heathen themes are fairly obvious. You have the slaying of the dragon. You have, you mentioned the funeral pyre. You mentioned, there's just like many things, the troll, Grendel. There's a lot of heathen themes. What did you see in Beowulf that could have possibly been Indo-European themes?
Okay, so for Indo-European themes, there are quite a few of those. I think actually what I'll do is I'll sort of start off with a couple of things in the linguistic construction itself, and then we'll move to the actual plot points.
Sure.
So the first one I noticed is that you get these verbal constructions. So in Beowulf, but also like in other Germanic poetry, you find these odd verbal constructions, and they're worth kind of delving into a bit deeper. So you get this what's called a periphrastic verb phrase, which is basically a way of putting something that's indirect. And instead of saying that, you know, Grendel killed one of Beowulf's retainers, the poet will say that that Grendel became the slayer to, or became the bane of, one of the retainers. And this is not just a sort of like poetic way of almost like a kenning or anything like that. In Old English, it's to bonen weorden, or weorden. And you get a very similar construction in Old Norse. You get it in Old High German, and you get it in Old Saxon, which is a slightly different language than Old English. And this verbal construction is always used in a specific context. It's always used to describe extraordinary killings. So as I said, Grendel eating alive one of the retainers, or Unferth's fratricide, or the death of Cain. These are all extraordinary killings that kind of like go beyond the bounds of, you know, it's not someone being slain in battle or something like that. And there are many, many cases like this found in the Poetic Edda. In Old Norse, it's Banaverða. This is the phrase itself. And you can see it as well in Hildebrand's Lied, Hildebrand's Lay, which is also another poem that's included in our edition of Beowulf. And now this could just be sort of like a Germanic commonplace, but I think what actually makes it remarkable is that you get the same thing in the Greek world. That is, some of the formulaic phrasing in Beowulf is actually held in common with Homer. So just think about that for a second. That's how well preserved some of this stuff is. It's all part of a thematic complex that's much, much older even than the Germanic world itself. Even the phrasing is cognate to the Greeks. So this is going back to the last common ancestor of the Greeks and the English, which is the Yamnaya. That's how old some of this stuff. This is how old some of this stuff is. Yeah, we're talking like 3000 BC or earlier. So the periphrastic term for slaying in the context of the hero slays the serpent motif is extremely ancient, and its usage is shared in Greek, where it's called phonos esestai, which is to be the slaughterer of. You find it all over the place. You find it in Odyssey when Agamemnon is reminding Odysseus that, unlike himself, Odysseus will never be murdered by his wife. He's doing it in the underworld, obviously. If we're kind of like dealing with formulaic phrases from the common ancestor of the Greeks and the English, this is really ancient stuff. And Tolkien, as much as I respect him, as much of a giant as he is in our circles, I think he got it wrong when he described the poem as something that's newly made and kind of characteristic of the individual genius of the poet. I'm talking about Tolkien's Monsters and Critics essay here. It is at least in part extremely archaic, and we're dealing with more than just a common phrase. It's a common stock of ideas and expressions, a common worldview, a worldview that's kind of shared around this North Sea orbit at the time, and much, much older than that. There's actually a whole field of study on this. It's called comparative poetics, and it was kicked off by a sort of similarly odd phrase that's found in both Homer and the Vedas. It was almost the same. In Greek, it's kleos aftiton, which means undying fame. And there's something almost exactly the same in the Vedic. So that's one of the verbal constructions. There's another one as well. And it's called the best of men, or the best of the thanes. And it's used in the context of a powerful figure who's about to die or is recently killed. And this one's no less archaic than the last. And we get this in the description of Grendel's mother, who's bearing off Beowulf's kinsman, Iskara. It says, she bore the bravest and the best one dead. And we also get an echo of it with the sword Hrunting, called the best of blades, that's used to avenge Iskara. And we get it again When Beowulf lays dying at the end of the poem, he's described as the mildest and most beloved, to his kin the kindest, keenest for praise. And you get some of that wonderful alliteration in there. Mm-hmm. We can actually contrast this with Scyld, the king, at the beginning of the poem while he's alive. It says, the poet says, "That was a good king," which is a different way of describing him, obviously. And this is not like, you know, when he says the best of men or the best of blades, it's not just a random use of superlatives. It's actually used in a specific context. And this is a poetic construction that's shared with the rest of the Indo-European world. Again, we can go back to the Greeks. You can see with Menelaus slaying Euphorbus, it says the best of the Trojans, or, you know, bring it back to the Vedic period with Indra slaying Vritra in Rig Veda. The Vritra serpent among all the Vritra serpents, and even survives in a later and sort of more sophisticated time in Plato's Phaedo with Socrates. And Dave, you and I've we've talked about Plato before. Mm-hmm. Here's something that he inherited from the Indo-European world. When Socrates is about to die, he calls him the best, the wisest, and most just. And again, these are not accidental usages. They're part of a common phrasal stock, but also part of a common stock of ideas. So, to kind of tie it up here, Beowulf is not just a poem of the 8th century, but it's much, much older than that. And it even has some plot themes that are comparative in the Indo-European world. But I'll let you guys get a word in here because I've been talking for a bit.
Yeah.
Right. So the chat here is asking, do you believe that the actual story and the events portrayed in Beowulf historically occurred during the Roman period when they were present in Germania?
Well, some of them certainly did. There's the historicity of, you could say, of Hygelac. And this is something that was kind of discovered in the 19th century. So for a long time, just to kind of give it a bit of background, for a long time, Beowulf was thought to be, you know, mostly if not entirely legendary, with almost no connection to historical reality, sort of like Homer was traditionally. But in the 19th century, a scholar by the name of Grundtvig discovered a historical episode that actually matches up with events in the poem. So Gregory of Tours, in his History of the Franks, he says that in the reign of Theodoric the Danes, in the reign of Theodoric, the Danes invaded the kingdom. But their king, whose name was Chocolaicus or Cocolaicus, something like that. It's a Latin name. Stayed ashore, and his thanes, you know, carried off the treasure. But then he was killed by Theodebert, son of Theodoric. And the etymology, which was greatly advanced in the 19th century, proves that Chocolaicus is Hygelac, uncle to Beowulf. The Proto-Germanic would be Hugeleikas, Old English Hygelac, and Old Norse Hugeleikr. And it's really, it's quite likely that although the chronicle doesn't actually mention it, Beowulf escaped by his feat of swimming that the poem sort of makes so much of in the middle of it. We also get a king by the name Chocolaicus in the land of the Atuarii, which is related in the Liber Historiae Francorum, which is an anonymous history of the Middle Ages. Atuarii or Chatuarii is the Latin form of the old name, old English name Hetuara, which is, related in, I think it's chapter, one of the late chapters, probably chapter 33 of Beowulf, where he's escapes by swimming. And anyways, in these histories, the king Chocolaicus is said to be a Dane, but we get the same name. It's preserved elsewhere as a Geot. You get parallels in the Liber Monstrorum. Long story short, there are definitely at least characters in Beowulf that are historical. It's clearly a harmonization of history and myth, because we also get the links with Bodvar Bjarki. All these mythic parallels along with historical parallels. So, yeah, it is not just a it's certainly not just an invention of the poet. It's not just mythological. There are real historical episodes in there. And this is something that actually 19th century Beowulf scholarship made a big deal out of. And it's the fact that it made such a big deal out of the historicity of the poem is kind of what caused Tolkien to write his Monsters and Critics essay to say, hey guys, it's also about the dragon. So short answer, yep, there's a lot of historical material in there.
Wow. Now, you mentioned one thing about the Danes. When we look at historical documents, when they're mentioning the Danes, they're not necessarily just talking about people from Denmark. Dane, a lot of the time, was a catch-all for people of the North.
Yes, yeah, it definitely was. That was, Danes kind of referred to the that horde on the horizon in the Christian era that you had to be so afraid of. And it's interesting because Beowulf is in some ways a real family saga. And this is another sort of very heathen aspect of the poem, especially in the context of around 700 AD, which would be about 2 to 3 generations, maybe 4 at the most, after Christianization of England, of the Saxons, Anglo-Saxons. But, you know, you have to think about, like, who was the Beowulf poet actually writing for? Well, he was most likely writing for the nobility, the kings, who are the warrior caste in society is always a sort of more traditional and more, reactionary. They hang on to the old traditions longer than almost any other aspect of society. They would have been slow to lose their interest in the old stories, the old gods, and the tales of their ancestors, their heathen ancestors. And this is clearly what Beowulf was written to do. It was written to please them, probably at the behest of one of these nobles. So you get a lot of family history in Beowulf. One of the things about the poem that's really striking is that there are all these digressions. It's not a straightforward narrative by any stretch of the imagination. This is one of the reasons why we titled each of the 43, I believe, chapters, because it can be a little bit confusing. What's happening when? Because sometimes, you know, sometimes he's talking about, you know, the exploits of Beowulf. Other times he's talking about these old, like, family histories, and it can be hard to hold it all together in your mind. So what we did, we titled them so that people can kind of keep it straight. But there are so many digressions and family histories in this. Basically, what Beowulf is a kind of a family saga in a lot of ways, and that involves the Swedes, it involves the Geats, it involves continental Germanic tribes. It is really there's a lot to be gleaned from this beyond just a ripping yarn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going to say that the digression narrative structure you've set up there is actually very present in Icelandic sagas, which if you ever read them, we'll go into long digression details about like some minor character who did this really cool thing during a battle and then we never hear from him again, or like the history and the lineage of this other character who was the neighbor of the main character, and it takes up like an entire page.
Yeah, and you get the flavor of this in, of course, Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings. And this is one of the things that, like, you either love or hate about Lord of the Rings. It's got the deep history. It's got the, the whole world that's been painted in with a masterful brush. And a lot of that has to do with singing the old songs and reciting the old histories and recounting the genealogies and the exploits of the ancestors and everything. This is something that is in itself very Indo-European, appeals again to that warrior caste who love this sort of thing. And I think that's why it appeals to us in particular in the heathen community, because I think we sort of have some of that, Kshatriya kind of worldview a little bit more than the rest of society. And Beowulf, just like the saga of, Ragnar Lothbrok or any of the other like old Norse sagas, it's got the same thing. So I think that there's a great deal that people can get out of it, heathens especially.
And it kind of, one thing that stands out to me about the story of Beowulf, and honestly about any sort of these old stories that outline lineages, it kind of blows apart this academic mantra of like hyper-regionalism among the Germanic tribes. It really does outline that there was a larger Germanic sphere, right? That there was, it was like pan-Germanic. You had guys from all of these different tribes that married in with each other, raided each other. They had histories together, and then they all claim the same fathers, right? They all say that we are descended from these guys. Or, you know, we mentioned King Skef earlier. He's a big one. You know, who is a King Alboin, who was from the Lombards, said that he was their grandfather. The Scyldungs, the Aethelings. There's like so many of these tribes from all over Europe that said, hey, this guy's our dad. So it really outlines how pan-Germanicism was a reality for our ancestors.
Yeah, absolutely. If you are an early medieval scop, which is the equivalent of the scald in the Anglo-Saxon world, then you are obliged to know something of the deeds of the, you know, you're an Anglo-Saxon, but you're obliged to know something about the Danes and something about the Swedes and something about the, like you said, the Lombards. And all these different tribes. This is a world that was, I mean, in some way you can understand why it was characterized as quite regional, because I think that these folk really did have great, like, deep loyalties to their immediate kin. But there was a sort of, like, you know, it's a series of concentric circles that, you know, these people would be very interested in their sort of extended family, so to speak, and the deeds of those, like, those ancestors and those cousin branches and everything. And the other thing about Beowulf is that, you know, Beowulf is kind of a, it's almost like a foundation story in some ways of, it's a memory of the old country for these Anglo-Saxons. None of it takes place in the British Isles. It's all in the old, like, Scandinavian countries or lands that, you know, these people's ancestors came from. So in some ways, it's a memory of days past, and it's a memory of where these people came from. Now, we shouldn't underplay the Christian elements in it as well. Those are definitely there. But for the most part, I'd say the story itself, it concerns heathens doing things that heathens do with the customs of heathens. There's so many, pagan and Norse and Danish customs in the poem. The poet clearly knew this stuff very well, and he had to know it well because his audience demanded it of him. They wanted to hear what was going on in the old country and in those cousin branches all across the North Sea. So, he had to know this stuff.
So, go ahead.
You know, Dave, I was actually going to say that it's interesting you mentioned about pan-Germanicism when talking about Beowulf, because one of my favorite instances in Beowulf is actually that you see the appearance of a Saxon king named Hengist, visits the Hall of Hrothgar, which, as people might know, Hengist is the legendary invader of the British Isles who, with his brother Horsa, basically established England.
Yeah, and for the folks that don't know, Thomas Jefferson actually claimed them as like the patriarchs of America. So Hengist and Horsa, their memory lived on even into the New World. So I wanted to kind of get into the heathen elements, maybe off the top of your head, stuff that is also found in the Poetic Edda or maybe in broader sagas. What in Beowulf did you find was like, this is a hardcore heathen theme or reference or something of that nature?
Well, as far as the actual, like, heathen themes and everything like that, there's just so many things from a, you know, like a basic level. Like you get, you know, in this, what's, you know, generally considered a Christian poem, and it is considered a Christian poem these days. It's interesting the sort of arc that, you know, Old English scholarship or Beowulf scholarship has taken since the 19th century. So in the 19th century, it was considered almost an entirely heathen, native Germanic poem. And then through a series of events, mostly having to do with world wars, these things kind of underwent a sea change very, very rapidly. But, you know, back in the 19th century, someone like Francis Gomera, the poet that did our translation, would have pointed to things like, you know, the use of runes and spells and ancestor veneration and kings descended from like Wotan and elves and giants, and especially fate as a driving force in the poem.
Yeah.
These are all things that you can see in the poem, and that like they just do not fit, or they fit only very uncomfortably within a Christian context. Like fate is kind of like sort of like equated with providence, but it's like you really have to read that into the poem because there's no explicit mention of that or anything. Just like there's no explicit mention of like atonement or, you know, the virgin birth or the cross or the Trinity or even Christ. There's no mention of Christ in this poem, which is very unusual for a Christian poem.
Yeah.
But so those are the sort of the broad themes. But you can also see more particular themes. Like I think that there is a very solid comparative comparison to be made with Bodvar Bjarki. So there's this line of thought that Beowulf is kind of like an expression of like the Beowulf himself is an expression of the agricultural god Beor. I don't think that's quite right. Probably this is the Beowulf at the beginning of the poem because. For those who haven't read the poem starts off with a genealogy culminating in a character called Beowulf, but this is not the Beowulf that like takes up the action later on. It's a different Beowulf. And there were traditions of two Beowulfs sort of like, you know, circulating at this time in this part of the world. There was Beowulf the Dane, the son of skilled chefing, and this is the one that I just mentioned. And then there was Beowulf the Geat, who's the hero of the poem. And most likely what happened was that when faced with like two traditions and the poet being kind of like determined to do justice to both of them, he probably took elements of both but made like the Geatish Beowulf predominate. And it's most likely that like the blending of the mythic Beor, agricultural god, and the historical Beowulf was originally a Scandinavian invention and not an English one. So we get this like uncanny resemblance between the Scandinavian legend of Bodvar Bjarki and Beowulf. So in both poems, you get a hero from Geatland who slays a monster that's ravaging Danish lands. He's a kinsman to the Geatish king. He's called by the Danish king. The Danish court actually stands in the same place in both of these sagas. It's the capital of the Scylding dynasty. And afterwards, the character fights on the side of Eadgils in Sweden. So this is what's common to both of these sagas, if you want to call Beowulf a saga. There are some differences. Unlike Beowulf, Bjarki, he's like a shapeshifter. Although he transforms himself into a bear, which is obviously like Beowulf is most likely a kenning for the bear, meaning Beowulf. That is the literal meaning of the word Beowulf. Another difference is that Bjarki is Norwegian, unlike Beowulf, who's Geatish or Swedish. Although the Bjarki story was written by Icelanders who are mostly of Norwegian descent. So, and the Grendel episode actually already also has resemblances to the sagas of like Grettir Asmundarson and Ormer Strolofsson. There are many parallels. There's one just directly with other, like, you know, Old Norse sagas, and there's others as well. There's even deeper ones that I mentioned before, like within the wider Indo-European world. Well, here's another one, for example, that actually links up with the Old Norse before we talk about the sort of deeper Indo-European plot themes. There's a parallel with the death of Baldur. So there's this episode of many of those these digressions that is narrated where one brother kills another. And I'm just actually going to – I've actually set up a little excerpt here. I'll just kind of read it. It says – it goes – "For the eldest of these, by unmeet chance, by kinsman's deed, was the deathbed strewn. When Heithkin killed him with horny bow, his own dear liege laid low with an arrow, missed the mark, and his mate shot down. One brother the other with bloody shaft, a faithless fight and fearful sin. Horror to Hrethel, yet hard as it was, unavenged must the atheling die. Too awful it is for an aged man to bide and bear that his baron so young rides on the gallows." So what you got here is the death of a character by the name of Herebald at the hands of his brother. And this obviously mirrors the death of Baldur in the Poetic Edda. Most people, I'm sure all your listeners know, Poetic Edda was composed around the 10th century, but the archaisms in it sort of put the date of most of the poems far earlier than that. So these poems could actually have arisen independently, probably as a result of like a much earlier common ancestor. And so in Beowulf, the story goes that Hrethel's son, Heithkin, kills his other son, Herebald, accidentally, and then the father dies of grief. So I think we can compare this with the Hother killing Baldur and the universe going into lamentation in the Poetic Edda. Even the names are cognate. You've got the Bald, and Herebald is a derivative of Baldur. The Heith, or Heith, in Heithkin is derivative of Hother. I mean, this could be a euhemerization, but either way, I mean, the basic shape of the tale has kind of been preserved. And the point is that Beowulf isn't just a sort of tale of a particular English hero, you know, of the 5th century or 6th century. It's hopelessly entangled with the Scandinavian and North Sea mythic complex of the old Germanic world.
Yeah.
These are very, you know, incestuous kind of tales that circulate among these people, and they don't really observe much of a distinction, like national distinction between them.
Yeah, and I also want to point out that excerpt that Mike just read, that is in Galdrelag. That is in the Sacred Meter. What he just read, the alliteration style and the poetry style, like I can't remember what he just said off the top of his head, but it would be like wading through waters of the river winding or whatever like that. That is what's called Galdrelag. That is the sacred meter of poetry that the Poetic Edda is in. It's what Beowulf is in, and we were talking about King Skef and Tolkien. Tolkien actually had a really beautiful poem that he wrote about King Skef, and it is in Galdrelag, or I guess it's called Lodahattameter, which is, you know, the sacred meter. So that's really cool stuff, man. This is we are coming up on 50 minutes. So is there anything else off the top of your head that maybe resonates between mythic heathen themes and Beowulf itself?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's so much. We could easily go for another hour on this stuff here. I would say, just to go into some of the deepest of all the resonances with the other aspects of the Indo-European world. You know, I talked earlier about the linguistic constructions. Those are really interesting. They're evidence of very, very conservative, like, preservation of the actual, you know, the themes and the worldview. But as far as the plot is concerned, there is a parallel with the Iranian world. So, I mean, Beowulf is obviously an original work by like one poet, but it draws so heavily from tradition and legend and folktale and family saga and everything. It's hard to imagine much room for like the individual genius of the poet, at least at the level of plot. I mean, there's obviously room for genius in terms of his like poetic form and invention. But one of the like deepest and oldest currents running through it is one that you actually find in the legend of St. George, and even as far afield as Persia. This is probably a mythic like or legendary motif of like extreme antiquity. So there's a Persian legend of the founding of the nation of Georgia. And in this legend, we get like not one but two warriors who come to slay a beast that's ravaging the land. Excuse me. And the names of the warriors are really significant. There's Bijan, which in Parthian is Beoj, meaning bee. And then there's Gurg, or Gurg. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. But it's cognate with the name George. And the name derives from the Persian word verka, which is cognate with varg, meaning wolf.
Wow.
So there's a striking parallel here. There's Beowulf versus Beoj and Verka. It's the same name, right? And even the name of the tribe of the Beoj is significant. It's the Gwarzi tribe, or in Parthian, the Gotarzi, which is cognate to the Geots, which in Swedish is Gotar. So Gurg, or George, later he takes on the visage of the wolf and then founds the nation of Georgia, the land of the wolves, which is the meaning of that name. So there are some deep parallels here between the legend of St. George, the archetypal English dragon slayer, and Beowulf, the national epic of Germanic England, and the Shahnameh, which is the epic of concerning these Iranian characters that I just mentioned. And like these parallels, it's a secure etymological comparison. Like these are things that just can't be attributed just to chance or reading them into the stories. Mm-hmm. And the last one I'll sort of leave you with here before we move on is a folktale type. So Imperium Press is going to be releasing a major book later on in the year in the same series, Western Canon of Folktales. And this is going to be something that it's going to be a compendium of 150 folk tales that are all sort of organized into how old they are and where they come from in the Indo-European migrations. Most of these folk tales are extremely ancient. So, but there's a folk tale type that corresponds really closely with Beowulf. It's not just found like throughout Europe, but even in Asia as well. It's called the Bear's Son folk tale. And the basic outline of the folktale is that you have a hero who's raised by or is descended from a bear. He has bear-like strength. He and his mannerbund, they have to defend like a dwelling against a monster, but they're defeated. But the hero then wounds the creature, the monster, and then puts it to flight. And then after pursuing the monster, the hero then descends into the underworld. And I mean, the parallels between this and Beowulf are just so obvious that we don't even need to sketch them out. And it's a folktale so old that it's we get it as far afield as Persia. We get it as far, in the ancient North. We get it in, continental Europe. This is a folktale that has extremely archaic roots. And it basically is, in its broadest outlines, exactly the story of the cleansing of Heorot, that first part of Beowulf. So, there's absolutely no question in my mind that Beowulf, at least as a story, as a kind of like broad outline of the plot, is of extreme antiquity. And when we're reading it and we read it with the Christian coloring in it and everything, and, the genealogies of the monsters that reaching back to Cain and things like that, that there is a sort of deeper layer, a deeper kind of like substratum that is legitimately heathen. So I think that pagans can get something out of it. Christians love it too. It's something that is just, it's European through and through, and actually Indo-European through and through. So that would be sort of my sort of ultimate take on it, I guess.
Incredible. So I have one final question before we close up, and I gotta ask this. And out of the movies, obviously there was a few movies that came out, Beowulf movies. You had the 3D one, you had Beowulf and Grendel with the Scottish guy, what was his name? I can't remember. He was King Leonidas in 300. And then there's like a sci-fi one. Is there one of them that you think which one do you think is most in line with the story? Or do you think they're all garbage? Or do you think they're all okay?
Well, Dave, I'm going to disappoint you here because I have only seen the 3D one. I haven't seen the others, so I can't really speak to those.
Gerard Butler. That's the guy's name. Gerard Butler.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't seen his nor the other one, but I have seen the 3D one with Angelina Jolie in it. I didn't like it because I don't like that sort of CGI. Mm-hmm. You know, CGI is fine when you're like, you know, rendering dinosaurs or like car crashes or like whatever. But when it's people, I find that stuff to be extremely uncanny and just I can't watch it, you know. So yeah. I didn't like it, but it doesn't mean that the story itself or the, like, you know, the movie itself is that bad. But I guess I would just say that, like, the definitive Beowulf live action film is yet to be filmed, I guess. Although I can't say that because I haven't seen the others, but I haven't seen the definitive Beowulf on film yet. And I think that is something that somebody needs to do.
So do you, but do you think that the 3D one was in line with the story, or do you think they completely just butchered it?
To be honest, I mean, I watched it so long ago. What did come out? Like 2007 or something like that? I watched it at the time. I watched it at the time. I kind of like was turned off by the visuals. And I hadn't actually read the story at that point. So I found it interesting and everything. But there is a really, really good documentary on Beowulf that I would recommend people watch. I think it's called In Search of Beowulf, and it's by, I think, a BBC documentarist, Michael something. Can't remember. Anyway, if you just look up In Search of Beowulf on YouTube, you'll find it. It's really good. It goes into a lot of the, you know, the poetic aspects of it, and, you know, as it sort of emphasizes that Beowulf is a poem of English identity. And it sort of echoes some of the stuff that I was saying earlier about it's the Anglo-Saxons looking back to their founders in the old country. And I think that this is something that we can really it's something that really resonates with us, especially as heathens and especially as, like, you know, people from the New World, like America and Australia and Canada, who do look back to the old country for inspiration. And, you know, we look even further back to our heathen ancestors. Beowulf is the people of that time doing exactly the same thing. So it's in a way like coming home. Reading this poem, we get a lot of inspiration out of it because these people are doing the same thing that we're doing. So, you know, heathens can get a lot out of this poem. Don't be afraid of the Christian references. Don't be afraid of the sort of Tolkien reading of it as something that's not primitive or pagan. I respectfully disagree with Tolkien on this here. We didn't really have time to go into, like, Tolkien's take on it, but I would just say that it is something that has a deep antiquity to it, and that the poet does justice to that. Kudos to him. As a Christian monk doing that, that's quite a feat.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right, Mr. Mike, unfortunately we have run out of time, but man, excellent episode. Thank you so much for coming on. Great show as always. We love having you. We love supporting the Imperium Press, which if you do not have the Imperium Press copy of Beowulf, you got to go get it. It's got to be on your bookshelf. So go to imperiumpress.org and go check that stuff out. Go get a copy of Beowulf from these guys. I'm telling you, it's the best in the world right now. Big Dave stamp of approval. So anyway, thank you everybody for tuning in to another episode of The Ball, which is live here on Dave Martell YouTube channel every single Monday and Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. If you like The Bog, you support The Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And you can, most importantly, get RSS feed so you can listen to audio of every single show that we do in your car, on your commutes, at gym, or at work. If you want to support The Bog another way, make sure you go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and check out some sweet merch over there. Guys, it's summertime. Get yourself a sweet bog cutoff, muscle shirt, sundress for the ladies. We got bucket hats. We got all kinds of stuff. And most importantly, we got artisan chef aprons for the esoteric order of grill dads out there. So when you got your kin and your kinfolk and your brethren coming over to do bloat or just hang out for a barbecue, you can flex your sweet bog apron as you're grilling up your pork chops and your steaks and your bratwursts and all that kind of stuff. But if you want to support a friend of ours, make sure to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and check out some authentic, ancient, Vedic astrology. I'm telling you guys, this is so cool. At least if you got Facebook, if you're still on the Facebook, go give him a like. You got to give him a like. The guy's incredible. Then if you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. And a final announcement, I am going to be announcing when the Bizarre Archives comes out. The Bizarre Archives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines. It's a compilation of amateur fiction authors that write in the vein of everything from Conan to Cthulhu, fantasy, sci-fi, horror, steampunk, whatever you can think of, just pulp fiction, like the old times brought back into now, all from our guys, from our circles. You guys are going to love it. It's coming very, very soon. I'll let you guys know when that's coming. And that's going to be it for this evening. Many hails and many blessings to each and every one of the Bog Lords and Bog Maidens out there that tune in and continue to support us. Man, I have so much love. We have so much love for you guys, for all your support, supporting us and all our friends and all the work that we do. And with that, I'm going to raise a horn to our most exalted patrons, our very own Andre and Mr. Corey. Hail to them. Much love, many blessings to each of them and their wonderful, beautiful families. And to all of you, this is going to be it for the Bog this evening. I'll see you guys next Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern here on Dave Martell YouTube channel. Hail.